So they were talking to the person behind the library, and they said that it would be very good to talk about something a bit deeper, but try to make it also intelligible and useful for those who have come here for the first time or they've only just started coming here. This is like a hard thing to do, to talk about some of the deeper aspects of Buddhism, but still related to one's the daily life of someone who's just come in here, but I'm going to try and do so. The subject of this evening's talk is a part of Buddhism which we call the five khandhas, or the five aggregates. This is a framework which was used by the Buddha and was used by monks ever since in Theravada Buddhism to describe what we might call reality, the cosmos, life and everything in it, to sum up the whole of existence in five categories so that it's helpful to analyze the nature of reality. And indeed, the Buddha often called his teachings a way of analysis as well as practice. So one analyzes existence, and then from the results of one's analysis, one's understanding, if you like, it gives one a framework to work with. To work with our life and our experience in this framework in order to give some marvelous and very interesting results. And I'm going to talk about these five khandhas and also talk about how the Buddha wanted people to use them and the results which come from using them. And I'll give a little clue. The result from using this particular framework in one's life is detachment, is a sense of emptiness, a sense of complete letting go, of non-attachment to everything in the world, outside and inside. But let's go back to the beginning, what these five khandhas are. This was a way the Buddha split up the world, inside and outside, if you like. The first of the khandhas was, or these groups of existence, was matter, including space and time in which matter lives, if you like. This is the whole of the outside world. People, things, the air, the planets, space and time as well. The whole thing, if you like, the world outside. That, in brief, was the first group or the first khandha. Khandha just means like a group or collection of things. It's not saying this is one thing, but in this category, in this box, you can put everything which is outside of your mind. And the other four categories was concerning the inside world, the mind. And it's always struck me from the very beginning when I first heard this category that only one category, one little box, was for the outside world and there were four categories for the mind. And it really showed from the very beginning that in the Buddha's teachings, the major emphasis, 80% if you like, you know, four-fifths, was concerned with the inner world, the mind. That's where the action was really happening, was the implication here. The outside world was interesting, but inside was the marvelous place. And I just remember just in my experience before I was a monk, I studied theoretical physics before I became a monk. And that really was a very deep and profound investigation into the world of matter, space and time. It was investigating the first khandha, the first group. And it gave some very interesting and very profound results. Anyone who's listened to any of these TV documentaries about whether it's quantum theory or chaos or relativity theory and got a, maybe not a full understanding, but at least a sense of what these top scientists were saying these days about what matter really is, it really starts to challenge one's assumptions, doesn't it? I know one of the assumptions I first had was that everything was solid. I was sitting on this chair here, and I never expected to fall through the floor or fall through the earth. But when one studies science, studies physics, one sees that most of what we call like the solid earth is completely empty. It's 99.9999999% nothing. The little atoms, the electrons and protons and all these other particles which make up what we think is solid matter occupy only a minuscule part of space. Most of this earth is completely empty. Most of you are empty. This 99.99999% emptiness. Not only is it empty, but it's in continual change as well. Nothing is stable in what they call like this subatomic world. Particles are forever changing changing their form, changing their shape, colliding and coming into contact with one another for a short while and forming atoms and molecules and whatever, cells, and then they change again and disappear. The cells in your body continually change. 7 years, then you've changed every cell in your body. I was reading there was one organ, I forget, I think it's the pancreas or something, which its cells change every few days. You get a complete new pancreas every few days, in a sense. There's so much change going on in the material world, and that's what one really sees when one really investigates matter. Change, instability, emptiness. This is actually what the Buddha was talking about. So when we look at matter in this particular respect, can one really hold on to this, attach to it? It's like attaching to something which is always slipping away from you. And you're never going to be able to hold it. It's like trying to catch the wind or trying to hold the air. These things are just impossible to grab onto because they're always moving, always changing. And the problem is that because the person doesn't really understand and accept the impermanence of matter, that we accumulate matter, we hoard matter, we get attached to matter, which is all very well, but what happens when the world of matter starts to disintegrate? What happens when the car you own starts to get rusty? And the fellow at the yard said, why don't you sort of trade it in, or why don't you throw it away? It's past its time. No, it's my car. One comes attached to it. When parts of our bodies start to fall off and get rusty. When our friends, the people we love, start to disappear because of impermanence. They're matter. We're made up of matter. And it has to end. It has to pass away. It has to disintegrate. This is the law of matter. Continual change, coming together for a short time and then fading away. Even this very earth, we think, is going to last a long time. The future of this earth, as anyone who knows a little bit about astronomy is concerned, is that the sun is going to expand. It's going to expand and get hotter and hotter and hotter. I don't know today, with today's temperature, maybe it's already happening. But the sun is going to expand and it's going to get so huge, it's going to completely swallow up the orbit of Mercury. And by this time, the Earth is going to be completely vaporized. The whole of Earth, with all its history, mankind, womankind, and all of our cultures is just going to end up as smoke drifting across the vast emptiness of the universe. What a wonderful thought. Is it really worth bothering washing the dishes, after all, when it's going to disappear by itself? Now, what that actually does to you when you sort of see just how fast things are changing, it gives a sense of detachment, but not a sense of irresponsible detachment. It gives a sense of, this is only going to be here for a while, I'm going to look after it. When it goes, I know this is nature. Nothing has gone wrong. No one's made a mistake. The problem is that, one, we don't look after things because we think they're always going to be there. My wife, my husband is always going to be there. The kid's always going to be there. Life is always going to be like this. So we tend to be heedless. I always like to, this is actually Ajahn Chah's simile, it's not my simile, a cup or a glass is fragile. If I drop this, it's going to break. Maybe not on this carpet, but if it's on concrete, it'll break and shatter, and I will not be able to use it anymore. Because it is fragile, because it is impermanent, I have to be careful with it. But I want to use this. It's good for keeping water in, giving me a drink. It's because things are fragile, because of impermanence, that's why we care. That's why we are careful. It's only when we don't understand impermanence, the change in the material world, that we become heedless. People living together, just in the world, with relationships, if you really understood that your time together is limited, there's a particular number of years or months you're going to be with that person, it makes every moment valuable. Every moment is quality time. This may be the last day or the last year, it doesn't matter, but it's going to be the last decade you're going to have together, or the last 3 decades. It's going to go. Once one understands impermanence, one puts more effort and care into one's relationships, into the things one possesses for the time being, into life. So this is just with matter. I don't want to go too much into matter at the moment because I want to go into the other four candles, which are perhaps a bit more interesting. The world of matter, once we analyze it and see it very carefully, impermanent, empty, and it means that we have to use it carefully, but let it go when it starts to disappear. The world of the mind is extremely similar. It also is completely changing and empty. But before we can understand this, we have to analyze it, because what do we really mean by mind? Actually, we've used this word quite often in the talks, but it really needs to be a bit more more detail given. So we have something to really work with when we talk about mind. The way the Buddha talked about mind, he split it into four categories. This is the last four of the five khandhas. The first category, which he called, was something, I have to use the Buddhist Pali words, but I'll try and give decent translations for these, or explanations for these. The first of these khandhas was called Vedana, usually called feeling. Now what it is the first mental impression which comes up when the sensory apparatus of the body starts to work. When one sees an object, when one hears a sound, or smells an odor, tastes a savor, and touches an object, or thinks a thought, the first impression which comes up, which the mind gives, is categorizing it in one of three categories: pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral; happy, unhappy, or somewhere in between. It's just like, I just noticed the other night, I was talking to the monk who was visiting from England, who was here last week. He went back this afternoon. I was talking with him in his hut, and he was leaning against the pillow, and suddenly went, ow! An insect had just bitten him. He said, ow! And then he said, what was that? In perception, in the conscious experience of the mind, the first sensation which comes up is either an ow or, oh, this is nice. Before we even perceive it, before we understand what actually caused that pain, or that pleasure, before we start thinking about it, and, you know, was that a sort of a red-backed spider, or was it a, am I going to die, should I go to hospital? I go into that part of the five khandhas, which is very interesting in a moment. But the first thing which comes up is just a general feeling of pain, or sensation, painful feeling, or pleasant feeling, or neutral. And it's an interesting factor of the mind, because this is beyond our control, so to speak. Once you have a body and a mind, the sensory apparatus, one has to have sensations which are painful, pleasant, or in between. Even if one is fully enlightened as an arahat, one still feels pain. If one gets bitten by a tarantula, one still feels pain. The Buddha used to say that it's like two barbs there are in the world, which are keeping on pricking us, causing us suffering, causing us unhappiness. This one barb is like just general feeling of having a body, having sensations. There are going to be some sensations which are painful, some which are pleasant. You can't do anything about that. And if an enlightened being puts his finger in the fire, ow. But the other barb, or like the thing which is pricking us all the time, is what we do with that afterwards. Saying, ah, why did this happen to me? It was your fault over there. Why do you light that fire? Why do you tell me to do this? And this thinking which goes on afterwards. And that's like, as someone used to say, that's like double dukkha, double pain. Ordinary dukkha, ordinary pain, you can't do much about, and it's actually quite tolerable. It doesn't last. This feeling, sensation doesn't last. You actually put your finger on in the fire, it hurts, but you know it's not going to be there forever. The pain eventually disappears. And actually, just the physics of the body, or the anatomy of the body, no, physiology of the body, that's the word I was looking for. Now, there's certain chemicals which get secreted afterwards. If the pain is too much, then sort of the pain disappears, or it sort of comes for a while and then disappears, and comes maybe again afterwards. But eventually it disappears. You know, Ajahn Chah's favorite saying, whenever he used to visit you in hospital, I've said this here before, some people may not have heard it, used to visit you when you were sick in hospital with typhus fever, feeling really awful, like a used tea bag. And not a used tea bag, it's hopeless, just soggy and sort of lifeless. And he'd come in and say to you, he said, never mind. He said, it's either going to get better or you're going to die. Thanks a lot. But in the end, I mean, that's extremely powerful teaching. You know that the pain or the discomfort you feel is not going to last. The nature of the human body is it's either going to get worse and you're going to pass away. So it's going to end. The pain is going to disappear. Or you're going to get better and it's going to disappear. One way or another, this vedana, this feeling, sensation, the major perception is just like a pendulum. It swings backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. If it swings to one side, it cannot stay there very long. It's got to swing back again. That's why that people in, say, very difficult situations, prisons or concentration camps, they may go through extreme pain, but even in that painful situation, they have a lot of pleasure as well, a lot of happiness. It's strange and it's weird if one doesn't understand the way of the mind. Wherever one lives, one always has to have both happiness and pain. One cannot get out of that. When one knows one cannot get out of that, it means one stops a lot of struggling in this world. And one doesn't actually struggle to get rid of the physical pain. One struggles to get rid of this, what we call like the second bhag, that which makes double dukkha, double suffering, which is the reaction to it. But just to put a little bit more on this vedana, this feeling, you do notice that the painful part of life is, if you like, conditioned. It comes, it arises from the happy part of life. And the happy part of life comes from the painful part of life. The symbol I like to give here, which brought this home to me very, very strongly, was many years ago at Perth Airport, there were some Baha'i refugees coming from the refugee camp in Pakistan. They had been through an enormous amount of trauma. The Baha'is were being persecuted by the revolutionary government in Iran, the Ayatollahs, fundamentalist Islamic government. And they'd lost many friends, many of their relatives were killed, tortured. They left all that they had, and they fled with nothing, not knowing where they might end up. What would you feel if you had to do that? And lost, you know, your husbands, wives, relatives, and lost your home, and lost any chance of ever going back. Okay, so these people had to leave. When they got to the airport, to Australia, to freedom, to some friends who'd been there before. As soon as they walked through the gate there, they were jumping up and down, waving their hands, clapping. And their euphoria started to spread to their friends waiting for them, and also to everyone else in that airport, including me. I was clapping, jumping up and down, and so I wondered, well, hang on, what am I doing? I'm not Baha'i, I'm a Buddhist. I don't even know these people. What's going on here? And I realized that, why are they so happy? It's one of those happiest moments, you know, in life, when other people are happy and they're jumping up and down, and you are too. Why? Because I always like to ask why, where's happiness come from? They were happy because of all the pain they've been through. Without that pain, that experience, they wouldn't have had happiness. Happiness is a relief from pain. Pain is a relief from happiness. The two go together, hand in hand. Look at that. When one is sick, you have a very bad sickness, and then at last it's overcome. When the fever dies down, I remember just times you had fevers in Thailand, it was typhus or something else. When you got better, you felt so happy and so well and so fit and so energetic. It only lasted for a day or two. And why was it you always feel happy when you get over the sickness? It's because of the pain and discomfort when you were sick. Prisoners, I know, once they get released out of prison, it's one of the happiest days of their life. That first day out. Where did that happiness come from? From all those months or years they spent inside. Now, after a few days, being outside is normal again. This is the relativity of happiness and pain, vedana. It's good to notice, because sometimes one could think, well, why aren't I happy anymore? Another one here is like falling in love. We fall in love, we're so happy. And then after a few years, where's it gone? Why don't I feel like this to you before, with you before? Why are you happy? Because you just met someone wonderful. And that happiness was because you never knew them before. Once you've known them before, you've known them for a few years, the happiness disappears. This is natural. This is Vedana. Okay, having dealt with how the Vedana is just like a pendulum. It goes one way and it has to go the other way. When one knows it goes both ways, one can accept it. It's inevitable. You have painful feelings and pleasant feelings. But what does a normal person do with these? The next of these five khandhas, the third of them, is perception. It's like just when this monk got bitten or had this pain, first of all, ow, his next perception which arose in his mind was, I've been bitten. Once we have a sensory experience, then we try and analyze it. Quite naturally, we have to be able to live in this world. We perceive it. We put it into a category depending upon our past experience. This is an insect bite because we've learned what insect bites feel like. And this feels just like an insect bite. This is delicious because this is that feeling which we've had before, which is delicious. This is red, this is yellow, this is big, this is small, this is profound, this is stupid. I like this, I dislike that. These are all perceptions which arise after that first feeling comes up in the mind. Now, one of the interesting things about perceptions is how random they are. I once went into a school of small children, and in part of my talk, I said, okay, hands up if you like rice pudding. And no one put their hand up. Well, one or two people. Actually, the question I said was, hands up if you don't like rice pudding. And one or two people put their hands up. This is only like year three or four young kids. Hand up if you don't like rice pudding. Three or four kids put their hands up. The other children looked around, and they put their hands up too, like children are. And I had most of the class with their hands up. Yeah, we don't like rice pudding. Okay, put your hands down. Put your hands up if you've ever had rice pudding. Most of the class laughed because only two or three kids put their hands up. Perception is very arbitrary, especially the perception of like or dislike. What do you really like? What food do you like? You always like that food? What would happen if someone put a blindfold around your eyes and they put some food in front of you and you had to just eat it? Not knowing what it was. Maybe I put sort of, you know, what we used to have in Thailand, maybe boiled frog in front of you. Don't you like boiled frog? Put your hands up if you've ever had boiled frog. Got you. You're just the same as the year three children, aren't you? How do you know if boiled frog is not nice? Perception, isn't it? If you ate boiled frog, you'd be a yuck. Perception is arbitrary. We have these unreal, untruthful perceptions which arise, certain stimuluses, this perception comes up. A lot of times that perception is with our relationships. Old Joe Blow, him. Or old Ajahn Chah, oh, what a lovely monk. They're perceptions, aren't they? And those perceptions are arbitrary. They come and they go, they change. And the main thing is you can't depend upon them. Perceptions. Sometimes you see your friend, sometimes you really like them. Sometimes you hate their guts. You can't stand them. Which one is the right perception? They're all right, aren't they? They rise, they pass away. So when we understand this part of the mind we call perception, we realize that we have to use it, but be very careful. You cannot depend upon perception, especially like and dislike. A lot of likes and dislikes, the reason why you like this or you dislike this, if you really analyze it carefully, you can't really sort of justify it. Or you like one person, you don't like the other person. Why you like yourself or don't like yourself. What's your perceptions of you? Is that really fair? So these are perceptions, and one has to be very careful about these. But the next part of the five khandhas is, again, extremely interesting, because this is what happens next after you perceive. You put in a little category, like or dislike, big, small, friendly, enemy, whatever. Then we think about it. This is called the mental formations, what we do to the in the next stage of sensory experience. And here we can concoct great reasons and justifications for being angry at someone. We can create great reasons and justifications for liking someone. We can prop up our egos. We can destroy our egos with a sense of lack of self-esteem. This world of thinking just goes on and on and on. One of these, this particular type of mental formation, the Buddha called mental proliferation. You take that first perception and you work on it. And from something very small, you build this enormous edifice. This edifice is built upon feelings and perceptions which themselves aren't valid, really. And so this whole world of thought which we have, of likes and dislikes, views and opinions, ideas, is that really valid too, if it's built up as something which is invalid? What are your goals in life? What are your aspirations? What are your likes and dislikes? What are your fears? What makes you angry? Why do you get angry? Why do you like things, want things? This is all in the world of mental proliferation. That monk who got bitten by that insect, as soon as the insect bites you, the perception, pain. The feeling, pain, the perception of this is an insect bite, the proliferation. Am I going to live? Am I going to die? What's going to happen here? Or is this something which is really dangerous to my health? You can think onwards and onwards, backwards and forwards. And that mental proliferation can be extremely dangerous for us. I think I mentioned some time ago the case in the United Kingdom about 100 years ago, where they took a man who was condemned to death by hanging to the prison washroom. They told him the night before they changed the law and that they weren't going to hang him, they're going to slit his throat. They took him to the prison washroom, having let him think about this all night, pull a paper bag over his head, and with the blunt end of a straight razor, they drew it across his throat. Put in no blood at all. It was a blunt end. At the same time, one of the people in this experiment, this very morbid experiment, turned on one of the taps in the washroom. Gurgle, gurgle, drip, drip. As if there was the sound of blood. The sound of blood, the feeling of the knife going across, just those perceptions were enough for him to think he had his throat cut. He fell down, he died. Nothing wrong with him. That is how far mental proliferation can actually physically affect us. They can kill us. If we believe we're going to die, we will die. If we believe, I'm hopeless, I'm useless, I can't do this, there's no way you will be able to manage to do it. If you have this feeling of lack of self-worth, which a lot of people do have, this anger towards themselves or guilt towards themselves, this is all built up of this mental proliferation, thinking backwards and forwards, time after time after time. One has created that oneself, and that can really cause enormous pain and trouble. The last of the five khandhas, is also part of that mental world, is volition. I want to mention this because this is an important part of that part of the mind which we call mental formations. As a result of what one experiences, quite often one makes a mental resolve to do, to not to do, to will it to go away or to will to keep it, to will to change. This is that thing inside of us which we can call choice or will. It's an important part of the inner world, will. So that's the fourth of these five khandhas, again, is this mental formations. Actually, that it was the box in which everything else, apart from perception and feeling, goes. The last of these five khandhas is consciousness itself. This is the umbrella. The umbrella, because every feeling is a moment of consciousness, every perception is a moment of consciousness, every thought in the mind is a moment of consciousness, every volition is a moment of consciousness. This is what consciousness means. I cannot just be consciousness and not be doing something in the mind. One is conscious and one is feeling. One is conscious and one is perceiving. One is conscious and it's one of these mental formations happening. Oh, I didn't actually mention that in the mental formations is all the emotional world as well. With hate, love, fear. This is all created by thinking. Okay, and so consciousness isn't an entity by itself. It's always associated with one of these other things. So when we talk about consciousness in Buddhism, it is just saying that the mind is active. There is a particular phenomena happening in the mind. To say, there's consciousness happening. And that phenomena happening in the mind is either the feeling, painful, pleasant, or in between, or it is a perception of I like, I don't like, or this is big, this is small, this is salty, this is sweet. Or it is one of these mental formations, thoughts or volitions happening inside of us. Now, having said that, the Buddha made it very clear that outside of these five categories, it's not really meaningful to talk about anything at all in the world. Everything in the world has to fall into one of these five categories. This is our existence. This is all we know. Anything outside of these five categories doesn't really sort of make any sense. If one would talk about, say, a divine being, a god, then a god would just be in the world outside, matter. Or if it's God inside, it has to be in one of these categories of feeling, perception, mental formations, or the consciousness which is the umbrella around it. It has to be somewhere. Having split up the world into such a refined five categories, it makes it very easy to see just how everything in this world, whether it's a god or whether it's a soul, whether it's this or whether it's that, has to have the characteristics of change. Every piece of materiality is in constant change. There's nothing stable in this world. Even like space and time change. It's a hard thing to understand that space and time can change. But just go and read someone like Stephen Hawking's Brief History of Time. It will let you know that time began, what is it, maybe 20 or 30,000 million years ago. Before that, there was no time. Actually, it doesn't make sense to say before that. Certainly before that, before the Big Bang, there was no space. Space and time were created in that Big Bang. It's an interesting concept, isn't it? It challenges one. But that's what the science tells us. So one sees that the materiality, all of these things are always changing. When one sees all of these things are changing, just with materiality, it has to happen. If one really understands this and takes the analysis properly and follows truth rather than one's own biases, instead of what one wants to believe, one follows the evidence in front of one. Not just logical evidence, but the evidence of our eyes, of our minds. When one follows that evidence, then one has to accept that there's nothing in the outside world which one can really possess. It's all changing, despite one. And one can try and maintain it the best one can, look after it, but in the end, it's got to go. One's house, one's car, eventually has to leave. When one realizes that, one looks after these things. But when it goes, all the time one has remembered it's going to go. When it does go, one doesn't grieve. One doesn't get upset. One doesn't think whose fault it is. This is nature. It has to happen. when it has to happen, one comes this wonderful feeling of acceptance. Acceptance of life, acceptance of the world, acceptance of arising and passing away, acceptance of birth and death. This is life, this is the world. You can cry, you can scream, you can do all you like, but you're not going to change this law of nature. With that acceptance is enormous peace. Awesome. This is life. When one understands that feeling arises and passes away, it changes, then the physical pain in the body and the physical pleasure in the body, one accepts, this is the way feeling is. And there's no way in the world that one can just get pure physical pleasure forever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever without getting pain. Nor can one get just pain, think that pain is always going to be here, without there being relief in some time in the future. So what that does, it stops one getting attached to pleasant feelings and sensations, and it stops one getting afraid, fearful of pain, or despairing with chronic pain. Eventually it will have to change, it will have to go. That understanding gives enormous power over pain and pleasure. This world we live in, most people in this world, are complete slaves to pain and pleasure. They run after pleasure and they try and grab it and keep it as long as possible. May this wonderful feeling last forever. I was eating a mango this morning, and you're chewing that mango. What a shame that it dissolves in your mouth so quickly and dribbles down your throat and it's gone. Oh, if only you could just keep that sensation for a lot. What happens if you did just keep shoving mangoes in your mouth? After about 5 minutes, you get sick of them. If you didn't get sick of them, you'll find that the taste wasn't enjoyable anymore. That's why the Christians used to say that, very wise, in heaven, this is the idea of a Christian heaven, that once every year, they take everyone from heaven down to hell. Just for one day, like a tour. Because if they didn't go and experience hell for one day, they would not appreciate the pleasure of heaven for the other 364 days. That's actually a very profound story. If you were just in heaven, day after day after day, you wouldn't notice the pleasure anymore. You need pain to experience pleasure. You need pleasure to experience pain. They go together. So when one has to understand this, whatever is pleasurable in the world, one does not attach to it. Whatever is painful in the world, one doesn't make such a big bother about it. Because one knows this is natural things, one has the body, one has to experience both of these things. When one understands perception as being uncertain, the likes and dislikes one has, the preferences one holds in life, one in a sense follows them. Because one will always eat the food one likes. One will go and see the friends one thinks are friends. You're not going to go and visit your enemies after this because, you know, you don't really trust your perceptions anymore. But you know that these aren't real things, these perceptions. These are just makeshift, if you like, scaffolds for the activities of our minds. They're not real. So when one doesn't take one's preferences for reality, it's possible to shift them. The person one hated, one can love. If that preference is solid, it's real, once you hate them, every time you see them, that, whatever you call it these days, swear words, that rotter, you can't use swear words up here as a monk. So you rotter, you cad, you bounder. Of course, you wouldn't use those words. But when you have fixed perceptions, there's no possibility of changing. When you understand that perceptions themselves aren't real, aren't solid, aren't built of indestructible matter, then it's easier to change. You can like your enemies, and you can find boiled frog delicious. What a lovely freedom that is in the world. You know how perceptions put us in prison? Certain things we can't eat, certain places we can't go, certain ideas we just can't stomach because of our perceptions of them. when your perceptions are more plastic, then the world is much freer. There's all sorts of people you can go and see. There's all sorts of people you can talk to. People who you thought, I don't want to see them. I don't want to listen to them. I don't want to hear them. I don't want to go here. I don't want to taste this. I don't want to experience that. I don't like that. When those perceptions aren't so solid, it's as if like one is coming out of prison. And when one understands even more than that, that while the mental formations, the thoughts in the mind, which we build up, our great fears of snakes or spiders, of this person in the office. Why don't you like them? Why don't you like them? Because you've thought that you don't like them again and again and again so long. You've built up this great edifice of anger with your thinking. And it's not fair. It's built out of stuff which itself is just arbitrary, your perceptions. You can't really judge another human being that way. Not fairly. Not if you're going to be truthful. Are you going to be truthful? Can you judge another person? Do you really know them enough to say, this person is evil, this person is bad? You've just taken a few experiences. Maybe there have been many, many experiences, but there's many other parts of them you just haven't seen. Many other parts of their character which maybe you weren't there to see and experience. Do you know all of that person? And even what you have seen, have you really perceived it properly? Or is it just like that prog? Just, I don't like that. Not really knowing what you're not liking. So the judging another person is built up on his mental perceptions. Once one realizes his mental perceptions are uncertain, it is Ajahn Chah's lovely extension of the word impermanence, anicca. He said anicca is impermanent, but it's also uncertain. Our thoughts are uncertain, he was saying. So you can't judge, you can't really know for certain. So it gives again a lot of freedom from judging other people, from judging ourselves, for judging life. What do you think of yourself anyway? Are you happy with yourself? Have you got this feeling inside that maybe there might be something wrong with you? Everyone else is all right, but not me. For I'm one of those people who are really hopeless. And where's that come from? That's just a mental proliferation in this world of mental formations. It's uncertain. Don't hang on to it. When you know this, you realize this, with just a few examples of the world of mental formations, then you know all mental formations are the same, uncertain. The emotional world inside of us is built up out of the blocks of mental formations. We say we're angry because we've had many angry thoughts, and that's this momentum in the mind. If you like, it's a karma of previous angry thoughts we've had a few moments ago, perpetuating this particular way of looking at the world. And we look upon the world just with anger. Or we look upon the world with fear, and everything which comes into our consciousness, they're out to get me. This emotional world is built up by mental proliferation, and that's why it is part of this world, mental formations. And volition, our choice. Why do you choose to come here this evening? Why do you choose to scratch your leg right now? Where does all this come from? Choice. Choice is also in this mental world. This choice is itself conditioned. You think you're in control of choice. I choose to come here. There are actually reasons why you wanted to come here. Causes. I tell the story that some years ago I gave a talk here on a particular, about 2 or 3 years ago, on a particular topic in Buddhism. On a Saturday morning, the talk was still fresh in my mind. I looked in the library and saw a tape recording of a talk with exactly the same title, the same subject, which I'd given 7 years previously, on the same subject. I got out a tape recorder, and I put the cassette in the tape recorder and listened to what I'd the talk I'd given 7 years previously on the same subject. And if I had any hair, it would have stood up, because I found myself saying exactly the same words as I did 7 years previously. Word for word, the same on particular subjects in the talk. And that shocked me very deeply. I thought that evening before I'd chosen every word I wanted to say. It was in my power to say blue or red in my talk. But I found out that it couldn't have been in my power, because the coincidence was too much. I'd reacted what I'd said 7 years previously. And it really made it quite clear, the myth of choice, the mirage of choice. We think we're in control, we think we're choosing all the time. Question that. What we're getting to here is not just a change of the five aggregates, but the emptiness of the five aggregates. The emptiness of what we call a self, or a being, a me. And this is a very important part of Buddhism, because having analyzed the whole of life and experience into these five categories, the Buddha said, well, where, if there is a self or a soul, exactly where is it found in these five categories? Is it in the material world? And every scientist or doctor, biologist or whatever, knows that there's nowhere in the brain one can actually locate a little bit of grey matter which is the soul or the self. The soul or the self certainly is not material. And if one looks at matter in theoretical physics, one goes deeper and deeper. You know, what's this made of? Atoms. What atoms made of? Sort of protons, electrons, neutrons. What are those made out of? Even more subatomic particles. What are those made out of? One goes deeper and deeper into the core of things. One finds there's nothing there. There's this dance of mirage-like particles which suddenly appear, and then you don't know where they are again the next minute. This emptiness, change, arising, passing away, and disappearing into nothingness, and then appearing again. This is the world of subatomic physics. You may not understand it, but at least you can understand or accept the results which these many physicists throughout the world, and not Buddhists in particular, are all saying. The emptiness of the physical world, the insubstantiality of it, the changingness of it, the profound emptiness of the physical world. And the Buddha was not saying just the physical world, the mental world too. You look at sensations, feelings, this pleasant, painful, neutral. It's always changing. Can that really be a self or a soul, something which is really changing all the time? A self or a soul has to be something essential, something which doesn't change, which was there at the beginning, which was there at the end, and was the same all the way through. Anything which changes can only be attributes of a self or a soul. They cannot be the essential, unchanging, core. Anything which is changing cannot be the core. Because changing, it rises, a pleasant feeling, and once a pleasant feeling is gone, it's gone completely, and it's painful. You cannot have a painful and pleasant feeling in the same moment. And the perceptions which arise and passes away, which one is the right one? Which one is really you? They arise and pass away just so much. That cannot be you, your perception. Perception is a phenomena which arises in the moment and then passes away again. I like, and then the next moment you're thinking of something else and you dislike it. The world of mental formations are emotions. They're not really you. They arise and pass away also. And the volition itself. Volition is not you. The choice. Sometimes that we think that this is the last abiding of the self and me. I choose to come here. It's amazing when you find out you didn't choose. Who did choose then? It's just the result of the past, the process of consciousness. Consciousness, is that yourself? What do we mean by consciousness? Hopefully during this talk you've understood that consciousness is just this arising of a mental phenomena, which is one of these three either a feeling, a perception, or one of these mental formations, arises and passes away. And with it, the consciousness of that arises and passes away. If consciousness was really you, where do you go when you're unconscious? That cannot be the essence of you. The Buddha used this in order to show not just the changeability of everything in this world, the fact that it's moving so fast, you cannot hang on to anything, but also the emptiness. The emptiness being the emptiness of a me. Once one sees that, that has profound implications. One will resist that because the ego is very strong. I don't want to not exist. There's something in here. Sometimes we say, that something in here is just an empty process. What do you take yourself to be? What do you take as a self? If you really think that you exist, I have to ask you, well, what is it that you think is you? Ask yourself that question. What is it that you think you are? Once you've said something, you've answered that question, ask yourself, does that go in the materiality box, or the feeling box, or the perception box, or the mental formations box, or the consciousness box, which has to exist with one of the others? Once you put it in one of those boxes, and it has to go in one of those boxes, then it's changeable. If it's changeable, it cannot be a self. Using this analytical, ruthless analytical, because it doesn't give any way to one's idiosyncrasies, one's preconceptions, one's the way one wants the world to be. The way that one wants the world to be in Buddhism is just not given any way at all. How you want the world to be is just doesn't count. It's the way the world is important. Once one knows this, then one comes to the very profound conclusion that this is empty. There is no self. Once one understands that, the result of that is non-attachment. There's no I in me in here. There's also no mine. The body isn't mine. The feelings aren't mine. Perceptions aren't mine. The mental formations aren't mine. No more, the Buddha said, are the leaves and the twigs in the forest yours. If someone comes along and takes them away, do you suffer? No, said the monks. Why not? Because the leaves and the twigs, they don't belong to us. In the same way, monks, the materiality in the world, whether it's your bowl and robes or your very own body, is not yours. Your feelings, your perceptions, your contents of the mental world, mental formations, your consciousness, that too is just like the twigs and the leaves in the forest. That's not yours. Someone comes to take them away. Let them. This is what we call emptiness. This is what we call freedom. Attaching to nothing in the world. Not even attaching to thoughts in the world. Not even attaching to consciousness. Consciousness comes, consciousness goes. Okay, I don't mind. It's all right to be unconscious. Okay, it's all right to have thoughts or not to have thoughts. I don't take them seriously anymore. Are you a slave to your thoughts? A tyrant with a sinking inner commentator inside? If you want freedom, don't believe your thoughts. Don't even believe that one. And the result of analyzing the five khandhas in this way gives rise to non-attachment. That non-attachment is freedom. That freedom is just like a bird who carries nothing with it when it flies from one place to another. That's a Buddhist simile of someone who's liberated. Someone who's not carrying anything in the world. Not carrying materiality. Not carrying feelings, perceptions, mental formations or consciousness. And I think that's a good sign that my time is up. So, is there any talk this evening about the five khandhas? Obviously, it's such a huge subject because it embraces the whole of the world. And impromptu, little talk. Are there any questions about what I've been saying? Or comments? Yes, John. That's one of the interesting questions. If there's no self, what passes from one life to another? It's exactly the same process which passes from one moment to the next. Here's the answer there. Is you're always changing. Now, your body is in constant flux. There are cells which are disappearing and new cells being created and being born. Feelings are rising and passing away. Perceptions are rising and passing away. Mental contents are rising and passing away. Consciousness is arising and passing away. What is going over from one moment to the next? Now, what is going over is this momentum of process, something which you can call karma. Karma is like the force, the push, the oomph, which is connecting one moment of consciousness with the next. It's like the action at a distance, karma, phenomena, having, like karma, sometimes people think there must be a messenger carrying karma from one moment to the next, like a postman, like karma, some act which you've done in the past, and it's like putting in a letter, and a postman carries it to some time in the future. There must be some sort of thing going across. The reality is that thinking there has to be something going across is just a poor imagination. It shows the poverty of one's imagination. I think there has to be something going across, rather than a thing arising, passing away completely, but the karma of that giving rise to something new in the next moment and then passing away. This is happening in every moment right now. And this is why one can see the truth of rebirth and understand what goes over from one birth to the next by looking at what goes over from one moment to the next now. What connects this moment to the next moment? Sometimes that people think one has to have a body to have the other khandhas. But anyone who's had an out-of-the-body experience knows that the mind can exist without form, without a body. Even when doctors look at your body and there's no heart, no pulse, and there's no record on the EEG either, on the brain waves at all. The brain is physically dead. And there's been a couple of people here who've had this experience. Going to hospital, the brain is completely dead. They've been in deep meditation. Then they come out afterwards. They just walked out of the hospital a couple of hours later. Which really shows quite clearly that how little a medicine really knows about the mind and its interaction with the body. The mind can exist apart from the body, this physical body. And that's why people without the body experiences are still completely conscious. They still have feelings, perceptions, and mental formations going on. They still sometimes have fear, still sometimes have peace, bliss, sometimes good feelings, sometimes bad feelings. They have the experience of seeing, hearing, just almost complete perception of what's going on. You may have had those experiences yourself. You certainly will have heard about others who have had those experiences. And there's been so many from all sorts of different religions and races that one must be really sort of stupid to deny that as a real experience in this world. So the evidence for it is just too strong. One has to accept that out-of-the-body experiences actually do occur. When one does that, one knows that the mind can exist without the body. That mind, though, is just a process. When the body dies, the process of mind continues. Just like the process of mind continues now. And that's why for many people, when they die, they don't realize they're dead. Because the process of mind continues just as it does in normal life. And there's not a great change in the mental world which will tell them that something has happened, that they're dead. And so there's just an example of how the mind can continue, and how what is continuing is not a soul or a self, it is just this empty process, which we call the five khandhas. One moment of experience arising and passing away, and giving rise to the next moment of experience, which arises and passes away in its turn. It's a hard one to accept, because we don't talk about it very much, and it goes against a lot of what we've been thinking in the past. Just as much as the revelations in theoretical physics, which tell us that time began 200,000 or 300,000 million years ago, goes against what we think is common sense. When they say that the universe, that space was created at the Big Bang, can you really accept that? Does it really challenge your common sense? I think most people accept that that's true, even though they find it hard to understand. Perhaps this is the same when I say that the mind is empty, materiality is empty, and all that goes across is an empty process. That might be hard to understand, but please, don't think, because you don't understand it, it's not the truth. That's actually what the Buddha taught. But I'll leave that with you, because if you really do understand that, you're on the first stage of enlightenment, Dota Sotapanna. And that's really getting there. So anyhow, thank you very much for listening today to the Five Khandhas. It is a difficult subject. Hopefully I've made it interesting for those who have been coming for a long time and having a few more angles on what these Five Khandhas are and what they mean, and especially how they're used for a meditator and what the implications of their use are. And hopefully that I've tried to keep it down to earth with some examples enough so that those who've come for the first time can at least get something from this talk. But we don't always talk about high matters here on a Friday night. Sometimes we talk about just ordinary how to live one's daily life and get by sort of talks. So next time I come, I'll have to give one of those. So thank you very much.